Today we talk with Diana Sheets, author of American Sweet. She has a research scholar appointment in the English and History departments at the University of Illinois. And welcome back. You've been here once before.
Thank you, Mindy. It's really a pleasure to be back here.
And you know, I don't know how to describe this book, so I'm going to read how you've described it on your website. American Sweet is a diary novel that parodies chick lit and confessional memoir. Nominally, it is a story about love and the American family, but behind the pink tulle fabric is masculine carnage, warfare, religious strife, and the schism fostered by oppositional politics. So tell me where this came. I guess we should start with you have this sarcasm to your writing that can be quite funny, but where does that come from?
I really don't know. Until I started to write fiction, I didn't even know I had a particular sense of humor. So one of the great joys when I began writing novels was to realize that I really could do comedy. And what I wanted to do with American Sweet is really sort of have a collision of cultures, and the principal character, Arissa, has gone to the Midwest. So I saw it as sort of Woody Allen colliding with Garrison Keillor, and, you know, from a feminine perspective.
Right. And having lived in the Midwest, you get a lot of that sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but the people are very friendly, sometimes overly friendly, that when you come from the East Coast, you're a little bit suspicious.
You're very suspicious.
And just in my own experience, I'm thinking when I was there and I met a woman who was a lovely woman, but so friendly. And I thought, what is her motive? Why is she being so nice to me? And it turned out she really was that nice of a person.
Yep.
But so it's kind of funny when you get these sort of jaded personalities that move into the Midwest and what can happen. So how did you choose to tell this in a diary form?
Well, I felt one character was too limiting, and I love the sort of triangular perspective. And I wanted this to be a story about a modern American family, but also a metaphor for the larger story of America today. Mm-hmm. And I felt by having three different diaries, you get three different first-person voices, and you get very different perspectives. So the mother, Rosalind, is in her early 70s, and what was really great fun with her is she's just almost impossible. And, mm-hmm. and to create a female character like that is just terrific. And then flighty Arissa, who moves to the Midwest, and then her sister Sophie, who's really very grounded living in Connecticut.
Right. So. And I have to say, I loved Rosalind. Rosalind is the mother. She thinks she's Jewish. And although we don't get into this later into the book, when you get her reasoning, you go, okay, I get it. I get it. I get why she wants to be Jewish. But it's sort of this funny dynamic because her two daughters are like, well, no, you haven't been Jewish. And she denies that Christian heritage that she had.
Well, you know, it's really in some sense you draw from your autobiographical story, but my husband claims this is entirely a fictional story. But my father immigrated from Germany. He was an assimilated Jew, and he never told his children what his background was. So it's sort of the Madeleine Albright story. We grew up thinking something wasn't quite right, and mm-hmm. not really knowing what it was. And I married someone who's Jewish. And when I was 19 years old studying German history, you know, I asked his sister what the background is, and she told me. So in a sense, the desire to study history was a desire to uncover secrets. And so this was a way of transposing my story of and even the American story of multicultural mm-hmm. identity.
We start out in the beginning of the book with a couple of newspaper articles. And I have to say, you'd never see a newspaper article written like that. They're more like something you'd see maybe on the op-ed page.
Yeah, the language is probably a little bit too sophisticated, but what fun. The model I used for that was Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities, mm-hmm. and I had this memory that it was only one newspaper article, and I was very relieved when I went back to look at it that it was a couple, and it just gave me the courage. And what I basically did was put the ending, it's the penultimate scene, mm-hmm. right at the beginning, because people no longer have the patience to go through an entire novel, and I wanted them to get a sense of the trajectory and the outrageousness of the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, right there, you just, that's a perfect word, the outrageousness. As I was reading this, I went, this could never happen. This is just so over the top. And there's a couple of scenes in the book that are like that. And then you kind of, but you get into the characters and the character development. I just loved the characters, as I said, especially mm-hmm. Rosalind. I really got most of my laughs from Rosalind, yeah. which was a lot of fun. We're talking with Diana Sheets. Her book is American Sweet. The other one that seemed really odd to me was the relationship with Goth, the screenwriter and director. And what started out as a dream for Arissa turned into quite the nightmare. And this was one I thought kind of seemed unrealistic until I thought about, because I thought, here's Arissa, who's a, she's an intelligent woman. She might be flighty, but she's intelligent. And you think, how did you get yourself into this situation? You know, it's something that seemingly is too good to be true usually is, but it gets that outrageous level again. But then I thought about the many intelligent women who find themselves as victims of domestic violence. And I went, okay, this makes more sense now when you think about it in those terms, how she could find herself in a relationship like that.
Right. And she's really out on an end. She's left her boyfriend and Ben, who's Jewish, in New York, and she's broken up with a man. In the story, to parody chick lit, almost every man Arissa meets, she falls in love with. So it's sort of ridiculous. But she's just broken up with another man she met in the Flatlands, and she's very vulnerable right now. And I want this really to be the story of America. So having her fall in love with a celebrity and then having it turn into a debaucherous relationship, it just seemed perfect. And then from a writer's standpoint, this is the transition from what I might call almost realism to fabulism. It stops becoming a strictly speaking realistic novel when she has this relationship with Goth.
Right. And she's a writer.
Yeah.
And she's in this writer's group.
Yeah.
And at one point she reads a part of, she's writing her memoir, and she reads a part from her relationship with Goth that, boy, oh boy, you can, did not go over well in that room with those folks who don't like anything uncomfortable. And, the reaction they have is not good.
No, they don't. You know, again, writers respond to things in terms of their material. So when I moved to the Midwest, I joined a writer's group, and I was reading chapters from the first novel that we talked about just a little while ago, The Cusp of Dreams, in an earlier interview. And the further I got into the novel, the more outraged the readers got. You know, they're the land of overly friendly people. Mm-hmm. They don't really like uncomfortable scenarios. And finally, when I got to a chapter called Knockdown, which was when the character Sue almost lets go of a colleague and wishes her to die and go out to sea in a sailboat, and rescues her and does the right thing. But the sense was that the reading group was almost saying murderer, and it wasn't clear that whether they were distinguishing between me and the character. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to have some fun with writing groups and characterizations, and particularly what happens when you're in a Midwest, a little bit provincial writing group with good intentions, but you're not playing by the rules. So
right, and as it goes to show, everything's subjective, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of comical, though, when she chooses that chapter to read, which is, as we said, has a lot of uncomfortable things happening in it. And I wondered if you, now you had that experience in your own book club. Did you worry that, I mean, when you worried about what people's reaction to this book would be like that writer's group? Because certainly there are readers who don't like to be uncomfortable.
Well, what I did for the opening, the first two or three diary entries when Arissa drives out to the Midwest, I trialed the beginning of the novel at the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, where a lot of the teachers from the Iowa Writers Workshop are. And it was the person running that was Gordon Menenga, and he's written pieces that have appeared on Prairie Home Companion. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, this would be great. Midwestern audience, even though people are coming from all over, and let's see how it flies and in the Flatlands and or west of the Flatlands, and the response was very good.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So it was encouraging. So right. I said, okay, I haven't offended anybody from the Midwest. Keep going. You know, let's see how it progresses.
All right, let's talk about Sister Sophie, who lives in the Connecticut suburbs. She has three sons. And here's another one. This was another comical situation because her three sons are all over the map when it comes to their religious beliefs.
Yep.
And you can see where this would be a tough thing as a mom to have these. And of course, then we get to Christmas and one of them, you know, wants to be Jewish. One of them's Christian. One of them was Hindu.
Yeah.
So they have to kind of change their celebration.
And then you get Kwanzaa because Arissa has a former ex-convict who's African-American. So you're not even juggling. You're now juggling four ethnic identities at a holiday, which is, you would think, is almost comical, but really, in my own family, we were having some of the challenges of this because one member of the family is more religious, another is definitely not. And mm-hmm. the question is, how do you conduct yourself? So, yeah.
And so why did you have it among the children?
Well, because I was trying, what you're doing when you have three characters is you're giving each character not only a distinctive voice, and Sophie is very controlling and obsessive compulsive and trying to balance many things. And Arissa is flighty, and Rosalind is a little bit strident. So I wanted to give Sophie's story a good arc. Mm-hmm. And it was, for me, it was challenging.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to go someplace really fun and interesting, and I felt that I was sort of trapped, and it was going to be a very boring sort of ordinary suburban Connecticut story. And so then I was really liberated when I realized that I could really tell the conflict in America through her own children. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, of course, it's a little bit outrageous to have one child be Jewish and another one become Hindu and the third be devout Christian. But what fun!
Yeah. But, you know, in a sense, though, as unrealistic as that sounds, I didn't find that so, because you explained it well in a sense that the one child who wants to be Jewish is really the connection to his grandmother.
Yes.
He's trying to please
yes.
his grandmother, because this family was a Christian family. So there that explains the one child, then the one that wants to be closer to the grandmother and wants to please her. And then the third one is experimenting. You've always got a child that one of them that's out there experimenting with something.
Yeah, the one who embraces Hinduism, he's a classic middle child, and he needs a different identity. And this way he can sort of embark on his own path. And, you know, it starts through a friend at school, but it's plausible. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, at this point, the novel's really going a little bit out on the limb, but it gives me the freedom to talk about through metaphor, the conflict, the political and social conflict over values that America is having. So not, you know, it's comical. You can laugh because it's one measure removed of political radio and political television. But on the other hand, it really is getting to the different values in both our personal families, but the larger story.
And how the two parents react to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So Rosalind suffers a sad event, and all of a sudden she loses her ability to speak Yiddish. And this that was funny because her psychiatrist tells her if it's important to her, it will return. And it does. So it seems her Yiddish is prompted by anger.
And aggression and you know, the frustration and anger that some people, when they get older and they realize their values are being discarded and the things that were the very core of their belief system are no longer embraced by other people. And if you're a strong character and to some degree you're used to having things your way and it is becoming less and less so, how do you hold on and embrace the craziness of life? And so that's why. And I found the Yiddish was wonderful because I wanted her. She's a very strong character. I wanted her to swear. I felt it was sort of undignified for a 70-year-old woman to be swearing in English. And I, you know, found this wonderful book by Fred Kogos on Yiddish slang. And the translations are outrageous. At the end of the novel, the translations are all there. And Yiddish is just an incredibly colorful language. And I just have to tell you one thing that's really funny. I wanted to do and when she lost the Yiddish, I was having trouble as a writer because her extra oomph was gone. Mm-hmm. It was like, and I was desperate, saying, come on, Rosalind, come back with the Yiddish because your character is falling apart. You can't desert me like this. So I was really thrilled with that. But the other thing that was very comical was my husband's, on his father's side of the family, they spoke Yiddish, and on his mother's side, they forbade Yiddish. And when I married Steve, he said, you know, I don't speak Yiddish. And so I had to go out and find a dictionary. And you know, my father was German. I knew a little bit of German, but, you know, I needed some help. And then when I started writing these phrases, you discover things. So his aunt all of a sudden told me that her Yiddish really wasn't very great. It was Yankee Yiddish. Mm. And my husband's correcting the Yiddish on the page. And I'm saying, wait a minute, you didn't know any Yiddish.
Yeah,
so it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah. And it's interesting here because when you're just talking about Rosalind sort of losing her oomph and you're going, come back, this is really a good example of characters taking on a life of their own. They're really not yours.
No, they really aren't. In a larger sense, the interesting challenge I had with American Suite is American Suite really came in response to moving to the Midwest. I thought what incredible material I had been in England working on my PhD, and I thought this is such a strange country. We speak the same language, only we don't. Mm-hmm. And when I moved to the Midwest, even though my mother had been grown up in the Midwest, half my family had gone to Iowa, I really felt I was in a foreign country, and I wanted to get that. And also in this writing group, I really got angry that you couldn't write what I would call the great American novel, and that as a woman you couldn't write in a more masculine way. Mm-hmm. So American Suite was an attempt to say, you know, the heck with you. Mm-hmm. I can write a women's novel. I'll show you. Mm-hmm. And of course, the comedy of it is in about 15 or 20 pages, I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I was getting so frustrated with the limitations of women's fiction and chick lit that I had to, you know, the novel went from gentle parody to sarcasm and mm-hmm. just wouldn't behave. So mm-hmm. in a sense, I did show them, but in a sense, they were partially right because mm-hmm. I couldn't write a tradition, you know, and the characters rebelled.
Right. Well, one of the things, I'm just thinking of what happens with Arissa and her relationship with Goth. I mean, I don't think most women would write something. It's horrible. It's a horrible yes. situation yes. that she goes through, and it's something that you wouldn't even want to think of as a woman.
But
right?
But
it happens. But yeah. But I'm saying it's one of those things that that's an uncomfortable part of the book for
right.
me.
Right. It is. And I was, you know, I was reading the story of Vo at the time, and you know, it was actually because of a French writer who wrote a memoir in that tradition. I, you know, it was in the Times and New York Times. So, but it also became it enabled me after that relationship. She can do these absolutely outrageous things that it's hard mm-hmm. to imagine her character could do
before that,
she
yeah.
And also I really wanted to capture the absurd notion of celebrity, which is in America today. Mm-hmm. And you need a screenwriter, you need Hollywood, you need mm-hmm. the West Coast, mm-hmm. you need something that's larger than life and that's all visual. And so she had to have that relationship before she could really write a salacious memoir.
Right.
And so it nobody wants that. But you know, we all think that we couldn't ever get into a relationship like that.
But you could. Yeah. You sort of hit on this a minute ago, but I wanted to ask you, you know, what it is that really bothers you about chick lit? Because, you know, you don't have to follow the rules. You can do what you, I mean, and I can see where you wouldn't maybe be a fan of reading it, but it bothers you to a bigger degree.
Well, look, for a writer, the first novel I had was represented by a Harvard-educated agent, and it really went nowhere after 9/11. And that was, you know, completed in 2000. And basically, Lulu, I had to self-publish that. Mm-hmm. And this one is really only through the help of my publicist, Victor Gulotta, did I get the publisher. And this was intended to be the great popular novel that would get my firstborn published. Mm-hmm. And I had a Columbia professor in education who was Jewish who fell in love with Rosalind. He said it was the best Jewish mother he had
ever.
I
thought so too.
Yeah. And my husband loved it. I mean, he said, forget that the other characters are nice, but mm-hmm. Rosalind is just, and anybody who knows that last generation of what I call Russian Jewish women whose husbands were always praying and they had to do everything. I mean, the closest American counterpart are African American women mm-hmm. who have really had to fend for themselves and develop really strong characters. So in answer to your question, you know, fiction writing has devolved to memoir writing, scandalous memoir writing, mostly invented, mm-hmm. which is why I'm really making fun of memoir in this. And the genres and chick lit, of course, has replaced women's fiction. And these are the only things that are selling. You have editors, and editors get fired if the books they represent don't sell. And they go with the easy solutions. And there's a few, and my personal feeling is there's a few men they want to, you know, it's mostly a feminized industry now, so they find a few literary men they can celebrate who are, in my opinion, mostly feminized, except for in the genres. But there are really very few options for women who want to break out of the mold. And if, you know, I looked at the New York Times list of their 10 best books, and of course they gave them all to fiction because fiction is dying, and all the names are predictable. And when I think about when I first discovered fiction as a child, every voice was different, and I felt every voice entered, gained me entry into a world, new world. And, you know, I don't find that anymore. Mm.
Let's talk about another sort of funny thing in the book. Arissa has a problem with animals destroying her garden. Varmints, as you call them.
Yeah.
So where did you get this idea to attack this with a bow and arrow?
Well, you borrow events from your life and then you fictionalize them. So the property that I have in Champaign-Urbana is actually the house was designed by Harry Weese, who designed the Washington, D.C. subway system, and just an extraordinary modern architect, early 50s. It's my dream type of house, very small, totally impractical, in 2 acres of woods. And so, I mean, I did have an arborist who came at the beginning. I basically didn't know what was a tree. And you discover this, you have all this glass looking on what looks like a national park. And you're a writer. You're trapped inside your house and you're watching this whole ecosystem. And for someone who didn't really know what a garden was, even though I had a mother who grew, like, as a Midwesterner, grew her own vegetables, all of a sudden I'm seeing what little pathetic garden I have out there destroyed by these animals. So I had a friend who was also a writer who was was an archer, and I got the idea from that. No, I don't dress up in combat gear, and no, I
don't. As Arissa did.
No, and I don't shoot the animals, although I'm tempted because I have a next door neighbor who feeds the rabbits, who then do enormous damage to my garden. But
yeah, well, it's sort of comical when you're reading that. Another classic Rosalind moment is you mentioned that Arissa ends up dating this ex-con, and Rosalind wants to meet him, and she wants Arissa to come home for Christmas.
Yep.
And she tells Arissa if she does not come home that she's going to move out there and move in with her and make her life
Rosalind is a Jewish mother, and she has a notion of the universe, and especially Arissa, her countercultural daughter, is causing her a great deal of grief. And so that is enough for Arissa to finally bring her boyfriend home, who's a wonderful, wonderful man who really, you know, he very ethical, very, very balanced, very sure-footed, everything that Arissa is not.
Right. And we didn't talk about Saul. Saul Rosalind's husband dies, and she enters this relationship with Saul. And this guy seems too good to be true.
He is too good to be true. I don't know. I have a Jewish husband who I think is a lot like Saul. Yeah. He's a mensch, and Saul is the quintessential mensch. And of course, because he is, he has to die. Mm-hmm. And from a fictional standpoint, sympathetic, well-balanced, good characters who don't careen into disaster are a terrible thing to write about because the reader quickly loses patience with that. So Saul's a good counterpoint to the craziness going on in this family because he isn't any of those things. And he really is balanced. And, you know, I think there are characters out there like that, but they don't, if you populate your novels with stories like that, you really don't have much of a story.
Right. I guess one of the interesting things about Saul is this sort of gives us a glimpse into why Rosalind wants to be Jewish, and a lot of it has to do with Saul's family.
Yep.
And she sees his kids visiting him.
Yep.
His, you know, the closeness of the family, and you know when you start writing about that and you compare, you go, well, yeah, why wouldn't you want to have
it's
that?
Everything yeah. she's yeah. wanted, and also Rosalind is an incredibly strong character, and to use an exaggeration, in the WASP tradition, there you can't be impossible, and especially Rosalind has a great soliloquy. You can't place demands on your children. The WASP scenario is buy a beautiful house on the ocean, you know, Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, whatever, Nantucket, and your children will come. Whereas in the Jewish tradition, the mother invests all her energies to make sure that, and it's also in the Asian tradition, to make sure the children succeed. But then there's this expectation, you owe me. Mm-hmm. And so as you age, the demands can really place great demands on your children, but in Rosalind's case, she can't. The children are all going their own way. They have no malice, but they're if you want, they're a little bit narcissistic, and mm-hmm. they're interested in their own world. And it's only in Saul's family she finds the values that were intrinsic to her life. And keep in mind, she initially grew up in New York, and she really, in a sense, she always really felt she was Jewish. The mm-hmm. Connecticut, suburban Fairfield County, Connecticut, seemed to her a very, very foreign place. Mm-hmm. In a sense, she felt she had been held hostage. So when she went back to New York, it was as if she was refinding all those foundational values that she grew up with, even though technically she wasn't Jewish.
All right, the ending. I'm not going to give it away, but it leaves us hanging. Now, why did you do that on purpose? Are you planning a part two on this? I mean, why not end it like conclusively?
Oh, because life doesn't consist of tidy endings. And if you do a tidy ending and if it's happy or almost happy, it becomes genre. And I think life is a mess. and also, I mean, I did open up, I'm working on a post-apocalyptic sci-fi, but after that, I want a lighter story. And I was thinking of doing a story about the crime guys who were in this and mm-hmm. having them solve crime cases.
Oh, the crime guys were kind of funny. That's right. They were in the... And that's quite the writing group that you put together there. You know, you've got everybody from... you've got the sci-fi guys, the crime guys, the, you know, Arissa and her other friend from New York who were the outsiders. And then the Midwesterners who always want these happy, cozy kinds of stories.
Yeah. in a sense, people want real characters. But I thought it was hilarious to make every writer at the writers group a genre mm-hmm. and to inhabit that genre, and so they all become personas, and I thought it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun. I have to say, I laughed a lot, and outrageous was a good word, because it was many times I went, this is outrageous.
Yeah, it is.
Yep. The book is American Sweet, Diana Sheets. Thanks so much for being here.
It's appreciate a pleasure, you. Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening. Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Tridle and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
Sometime after World War II, when they were bringing all the men home and bringing the planes home, the main navigation point coming into America was the Consulate Tower in Mattucket.
Dick Brooks, Nantucket native.
My recollection is of the Black Widow fighter bombers coming back from Europe. You'd hear them, but not see them for maybe 15 to 20, 30 minutes before they arrived, and then they'd come into view, and there were literally hundreds of them with the engines droning, and the ground would you could actually feel the ground shake with the vibration. There were so many of these planes, and it would actually turn the sky dark. There were just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them in formation. It was an eerie but proud feeling.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.